This is New Classical Tracks from listener-supported American Public Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, the best thing that you can do for this show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Inger Olafsson has dreamt of recording Bach's Goldberg Variations for the past 25 years, and he's finally done it. He's also been touring the globe with this work. He's devoted his entire performing season to these variations. When he came to St. Paul, Minnesota to perform at the Schubert Club's International Artist Series, he stopped by our studios and played for us. We're going to share that with you. And he also had a thoughtful conversation with my colleague, Melissa Owsley. Let's hear that conversation now. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Albacher.
You have said that you dreamed of recording the Goldberg Variations for 25 years, which means you were 14 when that idea popped into your head. Was there a particular recording that captured your attention?
Yes, I guess I have to be very honest and say it's the typical answer, the early Glenn Gould recording from 1955. I got that from my mother, who was a piano teacher. I got that from her when I was 14, and it sort of blew my mind in so many different ways and changed the way I think about Bach, and realized in an instant that Bach could be so many things at the same time. Before that, in my upbringing, I had seen Bach a little bit strict and academic, and he was used in my musical upbringing to teach me good manners, you know, to play evenly with both hands, not too much pedal, perfect control over dynamics, work on your legato or your staccato or whatever else, and everything was about the rules and how to do things. And then I heard the Goldberg Variations with Gould, who was, I think, 23 when he recorded them, or 22, and it's so full of youth and freshness. And, you know, I realized in an instant that Bach could be the great entertainer, the great virtuoso. He could be the philosopher, he could be the musical architect, he could be serious and not serious at the same time, and everything could coexist in Bach. And I realized how free that zone is. Gould, I think, opened my mind to this for the very first time. So that was 25 years ago. I guess I am a slow dreamer to have only recorded them now, 25 years later.
Yeah. Of course, he made that recording at the beginning of his career in 1956, and then he came back and recorded them again. Turned out to be his last recording. Very different when he came back to the Goldberg Variations. Do you adhere to one more than the other? One version.
It's interesting. It's a good question. I go back and forth. I think, first of all, you can't copy Gould. Gould is his own universe, and everybody has to find their own Bach and sort of create their own country that is Bach, you know, full of its own logic. You have to really be yourself. There are actually three Gould recordings. There is the two studio, and then there is the live recording from Salzburg in 1959, which is fascinating.
Oh, I haven't heard that one.
It's beautiful. It was released on Sony some years ago, and it's full of fragility and humanity, and it's not the same kind of perfection, perhaps, that you have in the studio work of Gould, but you get something else. It's Gould, the breathing, living human being. It's very, very, very beautiful. Very spontaneous and full of the unexpected. And I think maybe that's my favorite recording. But I mean, when you think about the Goldberg Variations, you have sort of two main options, I think. One of them is to try to have a unity and cohesiveness to all 30 variations, to link them up in one way or another. And the other option is to go in the opposite extreme and to display their variety of expression and to sort of tackle each one in its own unique identity. I think that second option is what Gould does in his first recording, and the other one, of sort of almost superimposing a kind of cohesiveness, is something he really goes for in the second recording, the late recording. And through my life of playing these variations, I have, like so many others, sort of gone back and forth between those two options. When I recorded my own version now in April of last year, I was actually planning to have a more structural approach to them, meaning I was actually going to connect them all in a rather intellectual fashion with tempo connections and all sorts of connections. And I had mapped it all out, and I never prepared as much for a single recording as I did for this one. But on the first day in the studio, my plan sort of, you know, fell to the floor because I felt that it was too limiting and I was lacking the kind of improvisatory spontaneity that you have to have in this piece. So in the end, I thought, how would Bach approach this piece? Not how would he play it exactly, because in the end, I don't think that matters, and I don't think he would twice play the piece exactly the same. And maybe that's the key, you know. I think there has to be that sense of sort of the joy of improvisation through the interpretation of the Goldberg variations. So I tend to think of them now a little bit like a solar system, where you have the aria as the sun, perhaps, and then you might have these 30 variations as 30 planets revolving around it, each with their own logic, but still bound together by some, you know, center of gravity there. It is, after all, always the same sort of passacaglia, the same chord progression from the aria that Bach creates these 30 different microcosmos. But I mean, what is the point of the piece? I think the point from Bach is to show the infinite variety that you can extract from the most minimal means. And so in the end, I think that is the message. The message is the diversity and the beauty of that diversity, and to allow it to be such.
When you play them live day after day, or maybe you have a break of a few days between, do you find it especially helpful to anchor yourself with certain variations?
It's just different every day. I just played them now here in St. Paul. Just this morning, actually, on a 10:30 a.m. concert, and I played them in a 7:30 p.m. concert last night. So that was about, 15 hours between those two performances. And, I mean, they're completely different, and every day...
The performances were completely different?
I think so. I mean, of course, not like day and night, but for me, yeah, it felt very different. Both felt rather wonderful to me. I loved it. But yeah, it's different every time. The journey has to be different because we are different from day to day, you know. And I think you have to prepare extremely well before each performance in order to forget everything that you have prepared and still be free on stage in the act of doing it. It's the great paradox.
I was thinking that when you talked about how you prepared for the recording and were so kind of analytical, that probably served you well in being able to free yourself when you came to your resolution of where you are now in the way you played them.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I've played them now, I don't even know, I think 50 times or something like that throughout. I did incredibly many concerts in Europe before Christmas, and now I'm in North America, and then I'm going to Australia and to South America, and I've already been to Japan and Korea. I've played them in so many different places, in so many different halls, on so many different pianos, for so many different publics. And all of this matters and changes your feeling for the piece. And I think this is probably the only piece in the world that I could actually do this with, have a renewed cycle of the Goldberg variations this many times without actually ever feeling fatigue or lack of inspiration with the material. I couldn't do it certainly with Chopin or even with Beethoven or Mozart. It would be unimaginable for me to repeat any other material than perhaps Bach and the Goldberg variations in such a concentrated period of time. Before the end of the tour, I'll have done them something like 94, 95 times at the end of it in June. But the beautiful thing is that I am far from tired with them, and I feel like I'm rediscovering them all the time. But not just them, I'm rediscovering myself, because that's what they do. You know, they both as a pianist, as an interpreter, and as a person, you know. Mm-hmm. So the way I read the piece now is different from in August when the whole thing began, and certainly different from the recording. So maybe I'll do another recording at the end of the tour. Who knows? Whether I'll release it or not, I'm not sure. But I think I'll do it for my own sort of documentation, and to see almost like a diary or annual diary, shall we say, or like a music annual for me.
Yeah. Well, when you said that you felt this morning felt different than last night, I found myself wondering, or was it you that felt different? Because, you know, it's a different part of the day. You had a different routine today than you did yesterday.
It's everything, you know. You know, the instruments that we play as pianists, the grand pianos, they have about 12,000 parts. They are extremely sensitive to any change in the temperature or humidity, not just inside the hall, but outside the hall. It all comes through in the air conditioning and everything. And it's incredible how pianos are different on rainy days to as compared to sunny days. And if the temperature drops, you know, a degree, you know, you feel it in the piano one way or another. So the audience is different in the morning as opposed to the one who came last night, just the way where they are in their day and night. I'm different, you know, I just had a lot of coffee this morning to make sure that I could actually have the concentration. And so that was very different sort of from a physical perspective than having had my early dinner, chicken salad, before the performance last night. It's hard to say any one thing about it, but I'm also conscious not to try to repeat myself. And if a concert has actually gone very well, you have to make a very conscious, at least I have to make a very conscious effort to not try to then redo that happy version of the piece, but rather to make myself think about it from a new perspective. Because once you try to repeat something that you consider maybe a success of the past, you realize you really can't. There's no such thing as repeating in music. And once you go down that route, you are most certainly blocking something in your hearing and in your spontaneous approach to the music.
Mm. Do you sometimes feel as though Goldberg is kind of this living, breathing person that's with you, and you kind of wake him up to see what he has to say on a given day?
Well, Mr. Goldberg, it's beautiful. You know, there is the story of the Goldberg Variations, you know, about the Count who couldn't sleep and Bach being commissioned to write these variations for the sleepless Count. You know, for a number of years, I thought Goldberg was the Count, the guy who commissioned the piece and paid for it. Turns out, you only have to go on Wikipedia. I should have done that earlier. But, you know, I mean, it's easy to find out that Goldberg was actually a 14-year-old student of Bach's, a harpsichord student and a young composer who died, sadly, in his 20s, but a superb talent. And young Goldberg, 14-year-old, incidentally, I was 14 when I discovered the Goldberg Variations. I'm just realizing that now. But Goldberg, he actually had to play these variations for the Count. And the Count's name was Kaiserling, Count Kaiserling. So according to the story, Goldberg Little had to take a room right next to the Count. And so when the Count was having a sleepless night, he would supposedly wake up poor little Goldberg and have him play one or two pieces from the Goldberg Variations to soothe his nights. And that is beautiful, but I think it's very symbolic that the Goldberg Variations are indeed named the Goldberg Variations as opposed to the Kaiserling Variations, because this is, in the end, the performer's piece. And each performer has to find their own Goldberg Variations, their own Bach, their own sense of logic. You really can't copy anyone in this piece. It becomes immediately apparent and the whole mission fails. So I think about Goldberg, not so much about what he would have thought. In the end, he was 14. But I think about Bach, but actually I don't care in the end necessarily too much about what he would have liked, because I think his mind about the piece would have changed, you know, with himself, as we all change and every performer and every composer changes. You know, of course, it would be very interesting to know how Bach would play the Goldberg Variations. And of course, I would give my right kidney to hear it, of course. But that wouldn't be the truth. You know, there is no truth with it. I mean, there, just like if you would see Shakespeare directing or acting in King Lear, that wouldn't necessarily be the best King Lear. Maybe it would be, but not necessarily. And it wouldn't be the only King Lear. And he would do it differently next year. I know that, you know. And Bach would play it. If he would play two performances in St. Paul, I'm sure he would play it very, very differently on those occasions. So there we are. I think about it and I don't think about it. It's a fun fantasy way of thinking about it. And more than anything else, what it brings you to think about is that the Goldberg Variations were written in 1741. And how do we see the piece if we try to approach it from that year, as opposed to seeing it through the lens of 2024? Because this piece has been an inspiration for an incredible amount of composers, creators. Think about the late sonatas of Beethoven. I mean, countless pianistic devices and compositional ideas and techniques come directly from the Goldberg Variations. At least that's how I see it, and it seems very obvious to me. And, you know, for us now in 2024, and with the recorded legacy of this piece, with the Gould and everything else that has come beautifully, you know, in front of the microphones, and then you think of Schumann and how inspired he was by Bach and by the Goldberg Variations, etc. It's very interesting to think about this piece. You know, Bach certainly didn't know that there would be such a guy as Ludwig van Beethoven or Mozart or Schumann or anything like that. And the piece just becomes even greater when you think about it from the lens of 1741. It becomes an incredible fantasy to the future, a letter to the future, perhaps, written, you know, way ahead of its time. And at the same time, behind its time as well, because the times of 1741 demanded classical music in a very different way. They wanted simple melodies with delightful, easy accompaniments in the early classical manner. You know, that was the music that was in vogue, and the Goldberg Variations with the fugues and canons and everything else in this piece was absolutely, you know, going out of fashion. It becomes even more remarkable to think that Bach created what to me is history's greatest keyboard work and potentially work of all genres for no audience. You know, he published this as, I think, the fourth and last Klavierübung. You know, he published four books in his life, which is nothing given the more than 1,000, you know, opuses that he wrote. And he was practically unknown outside of Leipzig in this time. It's hard to understand history's greatest composer to have such a low level of popularity. To write this for the future, but at the same time, in 1741, could he have any hopes of this reaching an audience in the future? Because at that point, people didn't play old music. They played music of this year and maybe yesteryear and maybe the year before that, but they wouldn't play music that was 50 years old in a concert. That was unthinkable. So when Bach is writing this, it's just so humble and magnificent at the same time. And it is like a letter that he, you know, floats in a bottle on the Atlantic Ocean, hoping for someone to find it. And thankfully, you know, it's found us. And it's found not just me or all the other pianists and harpsichordists and anyone else who's playing this piece, but it's found all these millions of people who know and love this music.
I would love to do just a little Bach 101 with you, because I think it might surprise people to learn how much is left up to the performer in playing Bach's music. So I'm going to mention a few categories and have you tell us what's in the score. For example, tempo.
It's very, very, very open with Bach. In general, sometimes there's nothing, and very often there's absolutely nothing. Sometimes he will write something like allegro, meaning fast, you know, moderato, or, you know, moderately fast, or largo, which means very slow. But it's so open, and he certainly was writing music before the invention of the metronome, so there are no absolute indications about, you know, measured time in the scientific sense. And sometimes with tempo, you have to also remember that the fastest way of traveling in Bach's time was, well, with a horse. So here we are. I mean, I'm guilty as charged. I have some very fast tempos for the Goldberg Variations, but we live in a different time, and, well, of course, we will never know.
Your variation number 5 is very fast.
Yeah, I apologize, and I apologize.
No, I like it.
Thank you. But yeah, it's extremely interesting with tempo. It's so open-ended with Bach.
Yeah. Dynamics, of course, this is a harpsichord, so we didn't have loud and soft. You couldn't crescendo, so that's completely up to you, right?
Absolutely. Well, you could also play it on the organ, and then you have the option of doing the different registers and really pulling out the different voices in a very specific way. But in that sense, you would have to pull out, you know, the registers, and then you're stuck with that until you change the registers again. But then you have to free your hands and find the right moment in the music that allows you to do that. So there's that. But I can only imagine Bach with the modern piano. I think he would be like a kid in a candy store, because it seems to be almost like a hybrid of the different possibilities. It has the clarity of the harpsichord. It has the sometimes the kind of scope and majesty of the organ, and it has the dynamic flexibility of the string ensemble. So it seems to me a beautiful hybrid that connects these different worlds of Bach's, you know, oeuvre.
Articulation is one that I love, and I'm wondering, do you find that you vary that from performance to performance, or do you kind of have an idea of what you want to do?
Absolutely. It's such a big part of it to me. But that's governed by the acoustic, and it's governed by the piano. You know, you play a sound, not on the piano, and the piano basically, you know, projects the sound until it hits the wall and comes back to you, and that's the acoustic, you know, that's the physics of sound in the simplest sense. And that is so different from hall to hall, and your articulation is absolutely governed by that sort of visceral feeling and constant evaluating of the acoustic. So the articulation and the dynamics, you know, within the individual lines are, to me, completely connected. That's probably my primary factor when it comes to variations through performance of this piece. I very often think about, you know, I want all the voices in the polyphony, in the multi-layered texture where you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe different voices having a kind of a counterpoint where they have a sort of a musical discourse, like a dialogue. I really want these voices to feel like separate characters, like as in theaters where you would have the lead role and then you would have supporting roles, but all of them are basically equally important and they all have a very sort of organic and biological communication where they're constantly, you know, shifting, and the texture is, yeah, like a biological organism, always alive, a web that is constantly changing. So the articulation and dynamics, that's my favorite aspect of it, and that's what you can do so interestingly on the piano, to really have that kind of democracy of the music and that dialogue inside the texture.
And then I'll mention ornamentation.
Sure. I think the ornamentation in Bach and in Baroque music in general is something that everybody has to find their own way with it. I sometimes do ornamentation absolutely in live performances. I do less of it on the record because I find that sometimes, you know, with repeated listening, if you do an ornamentation, it can almost get tired, you know, and you have to, if you want to commit it on record, it has to be basically as good as the music itself. And when you do it in a spontaneous act in a performance, you can be, you know, slightly more free and open to chance, perhaps. But I like it very much, but I think if I would be playing the organ or the harpsichord, I would probably use it more than I use it on the modern piano, because I find I have a lot of options anyway through the dynamics and the articulation and all the things and the pedals and everything on the modern piano. Of course, now, you know, you're going to get a lot of letters from harpsichordists and organists who are going to hate me for saying that. I love those instruments, by the way. I just think that the ornamentation has an even bigger role for these instruments than it has, in my opinion, and for my taste on the piano. But that's not an abstract truth. It's just a very, very, very subjective opinion that I'm expressing here.
Okay. That should cut down on the hate mail, huh?
We'll see.
Those are great answers. What are the biggest technical challenges for you in Goldberg variations? Are there certain variations that are just more challenging to play for you?
Well, different on different days. I think you can never relax with the Goldberg variation. It's not like you know the piece and you don't have to practice it. To play it is very athletic, and it's a little bit like doing Olympic gymnastics sometimes, you know, naked. I mean, it exposes you completely. It is a very, you know, human affair, but also you're trying to push your level as much as you can. But that also means you have to push the level of everything else. You have to push the level of the acoustic, you have to push the level of the piano and the piano technician that you're working with on that day. Because, you know, you need the mechanics of the piano to be as idealistic as you can possibly make them. That's a lot of work, and it's also a beautiful connection and cooperation that you have with your technician. Sometimes that goes well when you have a great technician, someone who understands you and gets your sound. And sometimes it really doesn't. And then you are at the mercy of the instrument, and you will never have the ideal results that you were hoping for, regardless of how well you play. Thank you. for the Goldberg variations, I wanted the setup of the piano, the regulation of all those 12,000 parts in the piano. I wanted to have maximum velocity and extremely sensitive, you know, going into a danger zone of sensitivity on the touch to allow for the utmost variation in terms of dynamics, textures, and speed as you could possibly have. Many wonderful pianists agree with me on this, you know, and you look at, listen to the famous Gould recordings, and both of them have an even faster action than I would have, resulting in a lot of sort of double hits on the note. So it means the hammer, which hits the string, goes so fast that it bounces back with such force that it hits the note again. So you have a ta-dang, you have this kind of sound in many of the variations through Gould's performance, because he cared so much about the speed of the action to be able to do what he was able to do. And he cared less about that. He didn't care about it, which I think is incredible, because it is when it happens, you know, my ears just sort of go like, what's going on? You know, the sustain and the singing line suffers, you know, in my opinion. But everybody has their own way. And then there are many pianists who would have a piano like I have it in my setup with my technicians, and they would hate it, and they would just think it's absolutely unplayable and it's uncontrollable, and it's just you breathe on the keys and they respond, you know. So it's incredibly personal. And it's governed very much also by the pace of your playing and what you want to achieve, you know. But yeah, I mean, so the technical challenges on every day, you know, they're just different. And the one thing that is certain is that you never know the Goldberg variations. You're always discovering them.
What have you learned about yourself so far through this process of recording and touring with them?
Many things. I think that the good thing I've learned is that I think I'm able to redefine them, at least for myself and hopefully for my public, in a way that makes me never become tired with them. At the same time, I don't think I'm doing any gimmicks with them. I'm very much myself, and I'm very honest in the act of playing them. I would never do an effect for the sake of doing an effect in the Goldberg variations. That would be just ridiculous. You don't really do anything. You try to become these variations, and they become an extension of you. So that's a good thing. And I was slightly worried before this tour, because I've never done anything like this, so many performances of the same material, and I frankly don't think it's actually been done in classical music to have a piece that with one program that's played in such a short period of time 100 times. Maybe it was back in the day, but that doesn't happen these days. I've never seen it, and so that was my concern.
And what was your goal when you decided to do that? What was in your head?
I didn't know. I mean, it's sort of embracing the unexpected and the unknown. I didn't know what was going to happen to myself or to the piece in my hands with this all these cycles of Goldbergs. I wanted to have variations on the variations, and I wanted to feel as if I was creating them anew in every performance. And it requires you to go deeper and deeper into the material. And what I've learned is also that, you know, you have to, before each performance, you have to really have that moment of deep cleansing the piece almost, and sort of removing past ideas from yourself a little bit actively, to allow new ones to hopefully, you know, take place and be born within you. I think also the more I play them, the more I appreciate some of the lesser voices, the supporting roles, the counterpoint, the polyphony, the voices inside the texture that are not the obvious ones. The simple leading narrative, but rather the supporting narrative and the way that works. So that if you would speak in terms of string quartet, that would be the second violin and the viola, the inner voices. So that's something that, you know, I feel like I've become closer with those parts as the tour has progressed, and hopefully that's resulted in something better.
Well, a piano recital is, I just think it's one of the most intimate experiences for the audience. But you also have to be willing to open yourself up for it to really hit home. So I appreciate everything you're saying about, and the way you've challenged yourself. That's setting the bar really high.
I think I have two favorite formats. You know, it is the piano recital and it is a symphonic concert, maybe three with the opera. But the beautiful thing about the piano recital and the symphonic concert is that they're so so extremely contrasting. The piano recital is perhaps my all-time favorite because the individual expression and the kind of union of a pianist with his or her instrument can bring something that is so spontaneous and so intensely personal. While a great orchestra performance has quite the opposite. It has the communal effect and this kind of incredible collective that also affects us, but very differently, you know. You feel the brotherhood and the sisterhood, you know, and the sort of humanity in a different way through an orchestral experience or an opera, Mozart opera, for instance. But you get something completely different with the piano. And that's why I think so many of the greatest composers in history have written so much for the piano, because it is so interesting, because you can't hide anything on the piano. You can't hide through orchestral color or sort of, you know, sonority. It sort of shows how these composers thought music on the deepest level. And there's no coincidence that Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, you know, these really greats had so many keyboard works in their catalog.
And also just the structure of the Goldberg Variations, where he brings the aria back at the end, which he wouldn't have had to have done. But it makes us sort of, I don't know, reflect.
It changes the whole meaning of the piece.
Yeah.
It's, to me, and to I think all of us who know this piece, more or less unimaginable to finish the piece on the Quodlibet Variation 30. It would be so empty somehow. Magnificent as that conclusion is, we really crave that aria because it makes us feel as if we are at the end of our life cycle, perhaps, or at the end of our own lives. You hear the aria and it's almost like someone has just sort of pushed it up on the mixer board that has been playing there the whole time, but someone just, you know, took the volume down on the aria. You feel that the aria becomes the one constant in a constantly changing world. You know, you feel like it is the one thing that will always be there. And when you play it in concert, it can sometimes feel a little bit tragic to return to it, because you don't want it to come to an end. You want it to go on forever. And the fact is, the aria will go on, but we won't go on. And that's perhaps what that conclusion and the return of the aria makes us so aware of.
Bach's Goldberg Variations, a new recording featuring Víkingur Ólafsson. Thanks to my colleague Melissa Owsley for doing this interview, and also to Valerie Kaler. She's our producer for New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher.